This wasn't just a movement, it was a government. The UNIA built ministries, appointed diplomats, trained soldiers, and wrote a constitution long before any African nation had its independence. While the world saw scattered people, the UNIA saw a nation and gave it structure. A president general led the charge. Courts settled disputes. Parades weren't protests, they were military rehearsals. The African Legion stood in formation. The Black Cross nurses healed the forgotten. And across the world, Black men and women pledged allegiance to a flag that no empire could recognize, but every soul could feel. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. Structure of a sovereign dream, government in exile. The UNIA did not behave like a social club. It did not act like a protest group or a charity organization. From its earliest formation, it operated like a government, a sovereign structure built in exile without borders or state recognition, yet fully functional in vision and design. It called itself the Provisional Government of Africa. This was not metaphor. This was method. The UNIA imagined the future not as something to be begged for, but something to be built, brick by brick, system by system. If Africa was to be free one day, then its government had to exist in blueprint form before it existed on the soil. And the UNIA would be that blueprint. Inside Liberty Hall in Harlem and hundreds of branch halls across the world, the movement created a model of Black self-rule that mirrored the formalities of any nation-state. There was a president general, elected by the delegates of all divisions. This figure served as both symbolic head of state and strategic commander of the movement's global direction. There was a vice president, a secretary general, a chancellor of the exchequer, and a minister of defense. These were not just titles. These were assigned to real individuals who oversaw departments, budgets, policies, and international outreach. Every local UNIA chapter had its own leadership board. They operated schools, ran community banks, handled logistics, and trained legions. They issued membership cards and identification booklets, created postal services and burial insurance, and held their own court trials for internal disputes. It was not chaos. It was structured, disciplined, and uniform. All of it followed a constitution. That constitution was called the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. Passed in 1920 at the first international convention in Harlem, it was a revolutionary document, not because it called for war, but because it named a people, not as a scattered group of victims, but as one global race of sovereign citizens with unalienable rights. The document outlined specific declarations, that the Negro people were one people across all lands, that they had the right to self-rule, that the term Negro was to be respected, not used as slander, that Africa belonged to Africans, both at home and abroad, that the Black man and woman were equal to all races and should control their own education, economy, and destiny. Within the structure of the UNIA, there were even noble titles bestowed upon key members. Dukes, duchesses, knights, and lady commanders of the African Redemption were appointed, not in mimicry of European monarchy, but as a way of restoring dignity to a people whose royalty had been stripped, stolen, or forgotten. One of the most effective branches of the structure was the African Legion, the UNIA's paramilitary wing. These were Black men trained to march, defend, and represent the military potential of a free African government. They wore uniforms, practiced drills, and paraded in formation down the streets of Harlem and Kingston and Monrovia, not to intimidate, but to send a clear message to the world. The Black man would never again be seen as defenseless. The African Legion was accompanied by the Black Cross nurses, the women's medical and humanitarian wing of the UNIA. They wore crisp white uniforms with armbands and provided free medical assistance in communities where public health was inaccessible or racist. They were the healers, the protectors, the first responders. They symbolized a new image of the African woman, not just as mother, but as organizer and soldier of freedom. In addition to its government, the UNIA had its own court system. Internal disputes among members were handled by tribunals with elected judges. These systems allowed the community to resolve conflicts without relying on racist colonial courts that rarely served Black justice. The UNIA also had its own currency. The movement printed stock certificates, promissory notes, and investment receipts for the Black Star Line, its commercial shipping project. It wasn't yet a fully independent economy, but it was the beginning of one. There was even a foreign policy doctrine. The UNIA had diplomats. Ambassadors were appointed to represent the organization in Africa, the Caribbean, South America, and Europe. They negotiated land for resettlement in Liberia. They held forums with African nationalists. They formed alliances with anti-colonial leaders long before most of them would become heads of state. This wasn't imitation of white governments. It was invention of a black one. It was sovereignty rehearsed. Inside every UNIA division, children were taught African history, public speaking, civic duty, and economic literacy. Boys trained in flag-raising ceremonies. Girls trained in business and healthcare. Weekly meetings opened with a pledge to the Pan-African flag, which was treated not as a decoration, but as a national symbol. Red for the blood that unites all people of African ancestry. Black for the race that was once scattered, but never broken. Green for the motherland that awaited its sons and daughters. To the world, the UNIA was just a movement, but to its members, it was their government, their identity, their future. The structure was not an experiment. It was a rehearsal for freedom. While other organizations waited for seats at the table of white democracy, the UNIA built its own table, its own house, and declared its independence. Long before the African continent would officially begin to break its chains, the structure of the UNIA did not survive unchanged. It fractured under pressure, infiltration, and leadership conflict. But the dream it built, the sovereign dream, remains the most detailed attempt in modern history to give the African diaspora a nation of its own. Not just in spirit, but in system. And for a while, that system functioned like a state waiting for land. A people without borders, but not without order. A government in exile, that dared to believe it would one day come home.